Tonight is our third in the series of 12 points that show Christianity is true. And we're talking about atheism, the new atheism. A raft of books have come out. Here are just a few of them. The Atheist Manifesto, God is Not Great, The God Delusion, God a Failed Hypothesis. Atheist books are on the rise. Just look at Richard Dawkins, Victor Stengel, Michael Onfray, Christopher Hitchens, J.L. Schlellenberg, The Wisdom of Doubt, Matthew Chapman, 40 Days and 40 Nights, Tim Callahan, The Secret Origins of the Bible, John Loftus, Why I Rejected Christianity, Michael Shermer, founder of the Skeptic Society and editor of the Skeptic Magazine. Atheists, most Buddhists are atheists. Many people don't realize that. Most secular humanists are atheists, and the rest are agnostics, by and large. All Marxists are atheists. 5% of people in America are atheistic. 30% of English are atheists. 60% of Swedes and 80% of Russians are atheists. That's much of the world right there. That's the Eastern Bloc. That's a lot of the Far East and a lot of Europe and America. Atheism is on the rise. In fact, if you don't like the church you're attending because they believe in God, you can go to an atheist church. That's right. It's called the Unitarian Universalist Church. Here's their ad in Time Magazine, 10-15-07. Is God keeping you from going to church? Well, don't let God keep you from going to church. Notice in the fine print, if you can read it, I think I can with my glasses. Maybe you're uncomfortable with the idea of God, or at least someone else's idea of God. Yet maybe you can learn, yearn for a longing spiritual community where you can be inspired and encouraged as you search for your own truth and meaning. This is a church, you ask? Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church. I was sitting in my office at Dallas Seminary a number of years ago, and the phone rang, and the pastor of the Dallas Unitarian Universalist Church was on the other end, and he said, "We've had communists, we've had strippers, and we think it's only fair to have an evangelical sometime. Would you come and speak at our church?" I said, "Well, if you don't have any strippers there and I can speak on anything I want, I'd be glad to come." And I went and preached the gospel. They had standing room only, 90 people. Usually they have 30 people. I spoke on Jesus, God, guru, or ghost. They were hoping for guru or ghost. And I gave them God. Now I asked, "Are there any questions?" Every hand went up in the audience. I answered questions for another hour. Found out there was only one person in the entire church that believed in God, some kind of supreme being. Everybody else was an atheist of some variety or not. Is it true that a theistic God exists? Point number three. In our 12 points, we've now reached the third one. We've taken truth about reality as knowable. There we answered agnosticism and skepticism. We've taken the opposite of true as false. There we answered pluralism, multiculturalism. And now we're going to talk about it is true that a theistic God exists. Because look where we're going. If God exists, then miracles are possible. And miracles can be used to confirm a message. And if the New Testament is historically reliable, and the New Testament says Jesus claimed to be God, and he proved it by a convergence of three sets of miracles, fulfilling prophecy, living a sinless, miraculous life, predicting and accomplishing his resurrection. Therefore, Jesus is God. And whatever God teaches, Jesus is God, is true. Jesus taught that the Bible is the Word of God, and therefore, the Bible is the Word of God, and anything opposed to it is false. That's exactly what we're going to conclude by the time we finish the series. Tonight, point three, is it true that a theistic God exists? I want to cover the importance of this particular topic, God. I want to talk about the definition. What kind of God are we talking about? And then the evidence. Why do you believe in God? Simply because the Bible says so? Because you were taught it's true? Or do you have any evidence for your belief? And then we're going to discuss why people reject God's existence. So let's begin with truth and consequences. If God exists, then miracles are possible. Because if a supernatural being exists, supernatural acts can exist. And if an absolute mind, God, exists, then absolute truth is possible. And if an absolute morally perfect being exists, then absolute morals are possible. And if God exists, miracles are possible, and there's absolute truth and morality, then the Bible is credible, because most of the arguments against the Bible are based on the denial of one of these, miracles or moral absolutes or absolute truth. And if there is a God and there's absolute truth, then life has an ultimate purpose. So there's serious consequences from believing that God exists. And there are serious consequences from not believing God exists. Because if God doesn't exist, miracles can't be possible. Can't have an act of God unless you have a God who can act. There is no absolute truth. There are no absolute moral laws because there's no absolute moral lawgiver. The Bible is not credible because it's filled with miracles. It can't be credible if miracles aren't possible. And there's no ultimate purpose for living. Truth and consequences. Bertrand Russell claimed to be an atheist. Karl Marx said an atheist, he claimed to be an agnostic, and Karl Marx said an agnostic is nothing but a gutless atheist, said this. Now listen, this is probably the most eloquent statement of an atheist worldview ever made by one of the greatest atheists/agnostics who ever lived. Man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving. His origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves, his beliefs, are but the outcome of an accidental collocation of atoms. All the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. And the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. How would you like that as a philosophy of life? But if there is no God, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. He hit it on the head, and he did so eloquently. What kind of God are we talking about? We're talking about a theistic view of God, the God of Genesis 1:1, who is super powerful, so super powerful he made the world out of nothing. A God who is super intelligent, so intelligent that he planned this whole universe and all the complexity of human life. He's morally perfect, and so he's given us a moral law by which to live. He's the creator of the entire world, a supernatural being who can intervene in the world because he made it, and he can intervene in it. In other words, we're talking about a theistic God. Theism is the belief in a super powerful, super intelligent, morally perfect creator of the world who can do miracles. That's the God of the Bible, and we want to ask the question, is there any evidence that the God of the Bible exists? But before we do that, let me distinguish this view from six other false views of God that are floating around that people hold in one form or another. Theism is a belief in an infinite, personal creator who exists beyond the world and who can intervene in it. Deism, which, by the way, some of our founding fathers held, Thomas Jefferson was a deist, Benjamin Franklin was a deist, Voltaire was a deist. He wasn't one of our founding fathers, but he was French deist. It's theism minus miracles. God made the world but doesn't monkey in it. God is beyond the world but he's not in the world. God can bring the world into existence but his hands are tied by the laws he made and he doesn't perform miracles. finite godism, the word finite meaning limited. A God exists who is limited in power and or perfection. That's Rabbi Kirshner's God. Remember, when bad things happen to good people. God can't do any better than this, so forgive God and go on and live your life. That's exactly what he said. A God exists who is limited in power and or perfection. Maybe both. He's not absolutely perfect. He's not absolutely powerful, or both. Atheism. There's no God at all anywhere to exist. Pantheism. God is the universe. God is the all and all is God. Shirley MacLaine waving at the ocean. I am God. I am God. Sitting in a lotus position meditating on her navel. Pantheism, Hinduism, Christian Science, many views hold this. Panentheism, that's not a misspelling, and I'm not stuttering. Pan means all, en means in, and theism means God. All in God, or you can read it in reverse, God in all. In other words, God has two poles. The universe is one pole of God, and then beyond the universe, there's an eternal potential. So he has a potential pole and an actual pole, and the actual universe is changing. It's also called process theology. Alfred North Whitehead, Schubert Ogden, John Cobb, and a number of people like that. It's mainly held by liberal churches and Christians, taught in a lot of Methodist seminaries. Polytheism, many limited gods exist in the world. Mormonism is polytheism. Also, Wicca is polytheistic. Many of the New Age religions are polytheistic, to say nothing of ancient Greeks, Romans, and Egyptians. So there are seven views of God, six false ones and one true God. We're going to ask the question, does a theistic God exist? Because if you prove any other kind of God, it won't help Christianity, because Christianity depends on a theistic view of God being true. The evidence for a theistic view of God. The first one is called the cosmological argument, from the word cosmos. The cosmos needs a creator, the cosmological argument. One form of it goes this way. Everything that that begins has a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe had a cause. Now, it's very simple, very logical. The conclusion follows from the premises. So if you don't agree with the conclusion, you have to deny one or more of the premises. Well, the first premise is solid. Everything that begins had a cause, because nothing can't cause something. If something has a beginning, it must have had a beginner. That's self-evident. Even Julie Andrews knew that. Nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could. Remember, she's saying that. The thing that we are going to give the evidence for is the second premise. The universe had a beginning. And there's piles of scientific evidence that that's true. Therefore, the universe had a cause. Now, if the whole natural world had a cause, then the cause must be supernatural. So it would prove a theistic kind of God, not a pantheistic God. Here are the five lines of evidence used by modern scientists to prove that the universe had a beginning. Second law of thermodynamics, universe is expanding, radiation echo, general relativity of Einstein, and energy mass at the edge of the universe. Let me comment on each of them briefly. First of all, the second law of thermodynamics, one of the most venerable principles in all of science. The amount of usable energy in the universe is decreasing. We're running out of gas. Only it's in terms of hydrogen. Once hydrogen has been burned within that star and converted to heavier elements, it can never be restored to its original state. Minute by minute and year by year, as hydrogen is used up in the stars, the supply of this element in the universe grows smaller. So if we're running out of usable energy, like pour gas in your car, heat comes off your car, your car moves, but you can't capture the heat and transform it to the same amount of gas. Or if you can, just let me know. You and I can make a lot of money. They don't even take patents that violate the second law of thermodynamics, because there are no perpetual motion machines. They won't even accept a patent from people because this law is so firmly established. If you go in a room and half of the sand is in the bottom and half of the sand is in the top, what do you know for sure? It hasn't been sitting there forever. Because if it was sitting there forever, all the sand would be in the bottom. Now, all of the energy in the universe is not in an unusable form. There's still usable energy. So the universe has not been here forever. If it hasn't been here forever, it had a beginning. If it had a beginning, it had a beginner. Very powerful argument for the existence of God. Agnostic astronomer Robert Jastrow put it this way. Now we see how the astronomical evidence leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. The details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. The chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time, in a flash of light and energy. So while liberal theologians are saying Genesis is myth, agnostic astronomers are saying is literally true. The universe had a beginning, and it started with a flash of light and energy. So the scientist's pursuit of the past ends in the moment of creation. This is an exceedingly strange development, unexpected by all but theologians. He's a little optimistic here. They have always accepted the word of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So there we have the results of modern astrophysics. Something called the Big Bang evidence, that the universe banged into existence out of nothing, and that there are what I or anyone, says Jastrow, would call supernatural forces at work, is now, I think, a scientifically proven fact. Now, that's very strong for any scientist and exceedingly strong for an agnostic. It's a scientifically proven fact that there are supernatural forces at work in producing the universe. Astronomer Victor Stengel said this, the universe exploded out of nothingness. There was nothing, and bang, there was something. Note, nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could. Things just don't bang into existence on their own. There had to be someone who ignited the explosion. A beginner. How do atheists respond to this? Poorly. A proponent of the Big Bang theory, said an atheist, Anthony Kinney, at least if he's an atheist, must believe that the matter of the universe came from nothing and by nothing. Now, I love this. I can't help but smile, and sometimes I break out in laughter when I read this. You know why? When I was growing up, we were browbeaten by atheists because we believed that God made something out of nothing. There was God and nothing else, and then God made something. And they would say, ha ha, ha ha, that's stupid. You can't make something out of nothing. Well, it's true. I can't make something out of nothing, but it's not true that God can't. Now they're saying, no one made something out of nothing. To which I say, ha ha, ha ha, ha ha. What's more stupid, to believe someone made something out of nothing or no one made something out of nothing? The atheist is reduced to the ultimate absurdity. Everything that begins has a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe had a cause. Second argument is called the teleological argument, from the Greek word telos, which means design. This is the argument from design. And we'll take the first form of it, which comes from the anthropic principle. Anthropos for man, the Greek word for man. And basically, anthropic principle says there was anticipatory design, that from the very beginning of the universe, it was pre-tuned, pre-tweaked for the emergence of human life. And if it hadn't been fine-tuned at the very beginning, life would never have emerged. So the argument goes as follows. Anticipatory design shows an ultimate intelligent designer, shows advanced planning. Human life shows anticipatory design. Hence, human life shows an intelligent designer. Everyone knows that the instrument on the left took a watchmaker. But the instrument on the right is far more complex than the one on the left. Infinitely more complex than the one on the left. And if a watch takes a watchmaker, then a world takes a world maker. All complex design has a designer. Sir Isaac Newton, you may recall the name. He's the one who discovered, not invented, the law of gravity. Says it's not to be conceived that mere mechanical causes could give birth to so many regular motions, since the comets range all over parts of the heavens in very eccentric circles. This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the constant dominion of an intelligent, powerful being. One of the lesser known facts is that almost every early scientist was a creationist. Almost every one of the founders of every area of modern science believed there was a creator of the universe and of life, including Sir Isaac Newton. He says it couldn't have happened any other way. Robert Jastrow, being interviewed in Christianity Today, said this: the anthropic principle is the most interesting development next to the proof of the creation, and it's even more interesting because it seems to say, get this, that science itself has proven as a hard fact that this universe was designed for man to live in. It's a very theistic result. There's that word, a theistic God. Why? Because before the universe banged into existence, there must have been an intelligent being who brought it into existence, who fine-tuned all of the elements and factors that would ultimately bring about human life. What are some of these? 21% of the oxygen in the air is just right for human life. Any more, the world would burn up. Any less, you'd suffocate. Gravitational force is perfect for life. If it were greater, you wouldn't even be able to lift your leg up to take a step. If it were less, you might fly off into space. The distance from the sun provides the right heat for life. Any closer, we'd burn up. Any colder, we'd freeze. Any farther away. The expansion rate of the universe. The universe is expanding, and the expansion rate of the universe is exactly right to make life possible here on Earth. The thickness of the Earth's crust, which, by the way, to give you a sense of insecurity when you go to bed tonight, is about the size of the skin on an apple. That's all the thicker the Earth's crust is. And it's moving in plate tectonic fashion and forming mountains. But the thickness is exactly the right thickness for life to occur. The tilt of the Earth offers the best conditions for life. Otherwise, get too cold at night, too hot in the day. The speed of light, 186,000 miles per second, is the proper amount for life to be here. The strong nuclear force that holds the atom together. They don't know what holds the atom together. They call it a strong nuclear force. We'd fly off into every atom would explode. The distance between the stars is necessary for life. If you saw Carl Sagan's Contact movie, you remember over and over he had a line that went something like, well, if there isn't life out there, there's a lot of wasted space. Not an ounce of wasted space. Do you know that the size of the universe is absolutely necessary for life to be here on Earth? There would be no life without it. The cosmological constant, energy density of space, is minutely right for matter to exist. And without matter, we wouldn't exist. The right amount of seismic activity. We're always complaining about earthquakes. Don't complain. Because if it weren't for earthquakes, the minerals would not be reprocessed and life wouldn't be possible. It brings up minerals that have gone to beneath the surface of the earth and need to be brought back up for life to exist. The position of Jupiter protects life on Earth. Here's a picture of our solar system. We're the third rock from the sun, the earth. And two more rocks over is Jupiter, big, big rock. Do you know that Jupiter is so big and its gravitational force is so strong that it sucks in like a vacuum cleaner all of the cosmic junk that's coming from the cosmos and that would hit the Earth? And there are things as big as the Earth that have hit Jupiter. Can you imagine if something as big as the Earth hit the Earth? All of life would be killed instantly. Just the right distance from the sun, just the right protection from Jupiter, all pre-planned from the very beginning. From astronomy, the anthropic principle, anticipatory design shows an intelligent designer. Human life shows that there's anticipatory design, hence human life shows an intelligent designer. From microbiology, specified complexity. What does that mean? That means the same thing you have in a series of letters in a sentence. It's specified, certain letters are chosen, and it conveys information. Has an intelligent designer. First life had specified complexity, hence first life had an intelligent designer. Suppose you're a cryptologist, and you're trying to break a code. You're working for the U.S. government, you're trying to break the Al-Qaeda code. And you see a bunch of letters and you can't figure out what they mean. You reduce those letters to numbers and you study the patterns and you can break the code because language that conveys meaning has a certain pattern. Did you ever have a tape with static on it? Well, you can take that static off because the language has a certain intelligible pattern, the static doesn't. And so you can erase the static and preserve the voice quality. The same principle is applied here. Specified complexity is a certain pattern sequence of letters that convey information. Now, we know that from the study of language. Who did it? A guy named Shannon at Bell Laboratory did the research, and he discovered that there is a certain sequence of letters that you have in a sentence that conveys meaning as opposed to gibberish. And that you can tell by the letter sequence, even if you can't translate it, even if you don't know what the message is, you can tell by the letter sequence that there's a message there. The same thing exists in first life. First life had specified complexity. And if specified complexity always shows an intelligent being, then specified complexity in the first living thing shows an intelligent designer. From microbiology, another argument, irreducible complexity. Whenever you get a bunch of parts all there at once, necessary for something to function, that shows it took an intelligent being to do it. You look in a junkyard and you got all the pieces of a car. That doesn't take an intelligent being to make a junkyard, but it does take an intelligent being to put a car together, all of those parts. Irreducible complexity always has an intelligent designer. Well, first life has irreducible complexity. It wouldn't be there if it didn't have all these parts there at the same time. Hence, first life had an intelligent designer. Here's an example, the human eye. Charles Darwin said, the eye made him shudder. No pun intended, I guess, but you can see why it made him shudder. Because it can't evolve. There's no way that could evolve from a light-sensitive cell because you're blind until you get all the parts. If you have 95% of an eye, you're blind. You have to have 100%. You have to have everything. You have to have the optic nerve, and you have to have the lens, and you have to have the iris, and all of those incredible things at the same time. While it's evolving, you're blind, and if you're blind, you're dead. Why? Survival of the fittest. So it doesn't work in a Darwinian system. It made Darwin shudder, and it still makes evolutionists shudder. You can't catch a mouse if you don't have all those parts there at the same time. Because if all the parts aren't there, it won't work. So while the mouse trap is evolving, it catches no mice whatsoever. All of them are necessary. Here's what Michael Behe, famous microbiologist, said. No one at Harvard University, no one at the National Institutes of Health, no member of the National Academy of Sciences, no Nobel Prize winner, no one at all can give a detailed account of how the psyllium or vision or blood clotting or any complex biochemical process might have developed in a Darwinian fashion. Other examples abound, including aspects of DNA reduplication, electron transport, telomere synthesis, photosynthesis, transcription, regulation, and more. And he put the challenge out there, and it has never been met. No one has ever shown a detailed step-by-step process by which these complex things could have, let alone did have, evolved. Let's bring it back down to earth. You love alphabet cereal. You wake up tomorrow morning, the box is knocked over, and it says, "Take out the garbage, Mom." Now, what do you know for sure? The cat didn't knock it over. The dog wasn't playing with it. The wind wasn't blowing. An earthquake didn't shake the house. You know for sure. Why? Because natural laws never produce a message. You could shake that baby forever, put it in the washing machine and shake it and dump it out, and you'll never get "Take out the garbage, Mom." It always takes an intelligent being. You're lying on a beach. You look up in the sky. You see "Drink Coke." You don't see anything in the sky, but what do you know? There must have been a skywriter there who put it, because the wind blowing from the east never does that. A hurricane never produces that kind of thing. Never. Just a simple message, "Drink Coke." And you rightly conclude there must have been a skywriter. Now let's apply the same thing to life. Life is specified by an alphabet, a four-letter alphabet called the genetic code. And these four letters are put in incredible numbers of combinations in order to form life. And when you find a living thing and you look at the genetic code, you always know there was an intelligent being there. Why? Because only intelligent beings can form letters into sentences and paragraphs, to say nothing of books, nothing of libraries. Example, one amoeba, top middle there, it's a picture of an amoeba. It's a one-cell animal. According to Richard Dawkins, the most famous evolutionist in the world today, atheist, said, one amoeba equals 1,000 sets of an encyclopedia. That is, inside of one amoeba, the four-letter genetic alphabet, if you spelled it all out in English and printed it in books, it would be 1,000 sets of an encyclopedia for a one-cell animal. They used to talk about life evolving from simple to complex. There is no simple life. The simplest form of life has 1,000 sets of encyclopedias. Question, would you believe me if I said that my one set of a Britannica, Encyclopedia Britannica, resulted from an explosion in a printing shop? I was walking by this printing shop, and somebody threw a bomb in there. They had all the paper and all the print and everything, and the Encyclopedia Britannica, A through Z, with every article, came out. You wouldn't believe that. Well, this is why we wrote a book called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. I don't have enough faith to believe that a one-cell animal could have evolved. Too complex, way too complex. The conclusion of intelligent design, says Behe, flows naturally from the data itself, not from sacred books or sectarian beliefs. I'm not quoting the Bible. Inferring that biochemical systems were designed by an intelligent agent is a humdrum process that requires no new principles of logic or science. Life on Earth, at its most fundamental level, in its most critical components, is the product of intelligent activity. Now, you can see why evolutionists don't want this taught in school. Makes too much sense. Makes too much sense. And some of the kids might be influenced by it. And they might even come to a conclusion that there's a God out there. Forbid, God forbid, that that should happen. Carl Sagan and his friends were involved in the SETI program, S-E-T-I, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. The one nice thing about the program of studying outer space, your tax dollars are going farther. And in this program, what were they doing? They had these telescopes tuned to outer space to hear a message from E.T. That's right. Extraterrestrial intelligence, and they believe that someday they're going to get a message. They didn't get a message before Sagan died, so he made a movie called Contact. In the movie, you can do anything. In the movie, they got a message. How many of you saw Contact? What was the message? Every prime number from 2 to 101. They said, had to be an intelligent being. That's all. That's all, every prime number from 2 to 101, and it must have been an intelligence out there. Well, let me ask you this. How many seats were in the old Coliseum? 20,000. If you put 1,000 books on every chair, right through the roof, 1,000 books would go right through the roof. On every chair, not every section, that would be 2 million volumes. That's the Library of Congress. You say, that's a lot of books. It is. But you know what? The human brain contains 20 million volumes full of genetic information. Between every pair of ears in this room is the Library of Congress. You say, well, I wish I had a card catalog and could access it. It's genetic information. Now, if a one-cell animal is 1,000 sets of encyclopedia and the brain is 20 million volumes, and drink Coke and take out the garbage mom takes an intelligent being. Now, can you tell me why it doesn't take an intelligent being to produce 20 million volumes? I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. Microbiology, specified complexities. As an intelligent designer, first life has specified complexity, hence first life has an intelligent designer. Irreducible complexity has an intelligent designer. First life has irreducible complexity, hence first life has an intelligent designer. Third argument, the moral argument. The moral argument is a lot more persuasive to most people who aren't in the scientific realms, and therefore C.S. Lewis wrote his whole book, Part One, built on the moral argument. And if you have an atheist friend, there's no better book you can give them than Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. Here's his argument. Every law has a lawgiver. Every prescription has a prescriber. Every legislation has a legislator. There is an absolute moral law. Therefore, there must be an absolute moral lawgiver. Very potent argument. The first premise is self-evident. If you go to the pharmacist and say, would you fill this prescription? And the pharmacist says, who prescribed it? You say, nobody. It's just a prescription. He would think you were crazy, right? Because every prescription has a prescriber. And every legislation has a legislator. And every law has a lawgiver. The real question is there an objective moral law? So the burden of the proof rests on premise number two. And I'm going to give you several reasons why I believe there is an objective moral law. And if there is an objective moral law, then there must be an objective moral law giver. Reason number one, we can't know what is unjust unless we know what is just. C.S. Lewis was an atheist, as I said in the previous lecture. As an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man doesn't call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. How would you know that line is crooked on the bottom of the page unless you knew what straight meant? How do you know the universe is crooked unless you know what straight means? Rabbi Zacharias has a very beautiful way of doing this. He was giving his Harvard Veritas lectures, and there was a lady who was a relativist, and she was giving him a hard time, saying, well, I believe everything is relative. There are no absolutes, and on and on and on. And Ravi, in his typical suave, his typical Indian suave, said to her, ma'am, maybe we can get to the heart of this. Let me just ask you one question, if you don't mind. Is there anything wrong anywhere? Is there anything wrong anywhere? Now, if she said yes, then she believed that there was a moral law. How would she know it's wrong if she didn't have the standard for right? If she said no, then she could never again complain about any injustice or intolerance or bigotry in the world. If there's anything wrong anywhere, there must be an objective moral law. Otherwise, it's not really wrong. It's just your opinion, your feeling. Doesn't make any difference. I feel differently. Argument number two, absolutes are undeniable. Try saying, I'm absolutely sure there are no absolutes, and you'll see why. You should never say never. Or you should always avoid using the word always. Joseph Fletcher, the father of situation ethics, in his book by that title said, we should always avoid always and never use never and absolutely avoid absolutes. And then he went on to say, there's only one absolute love. Well, how do you get that? I thought we weren't supposed to use words like only or never or always. And then he went on to say, no unwanted baby should ever be born. Well, I thought you told us not to use words like no. See, everybody has absolutes. You can't avoid them. They're literally unavoidable. Third, moral comparisons demand an objective moral law. And yet everyone makes moral comparisons. In every culture, everywhere in the world, people make moral comparisons like we make this one. Mother Teresa is better than Hitler. But how do we know? I'll tell you how. Which one would you want to babysit your children? Mother Teresa is better than Hitler. We know that. But you can't say something is better unless you know what best is. Because better is compared to best. Otherwise, it's just different. It's not better. Four, liberals say the world is getting better. Conservatives say it's getting worse. Neither a liberal nor a conservative can say either one if there's not an absolute moral standard. Because how could we say civilization is getting better unless we had a standard outside of civilization by which we're measuring it? Or worse, doesn't matter. True progress or regress demands an absolute standard. Suppose you're sitting at a red light, probably happened to you. You look over and the car next to you is moving back. Or are you moving forward? You don't know which, right? So you usually go for the brake. What if the brake isn't working? Now who's moving? Well, you look for a tree. What if the tree's moving? See, something's got to ultimately be standing still in order to measure which direction you're going. There's got to be some yardstick there. You couldn't even measure change unless you had something unchanging. In the ancient world, there was a man named Heraclitus. Heraclitus said, no one steps into the same river twice. Why? Well, it's different drops of water, different leaves, different twigs, different fish. You never step into the same river twice. And people have developed what's called the flux philosophy based on that, that all of life is changing, nothing is absolute. But they don't read carefully what Heraclitus said. Heraclitus said, I know there is change because beneath the change, there is an unchanging logos. In the beginning was the logos. There was an unchanging logos by which I can measure the change. Five, everything can't be relative. Because it can't be relative to what's relative to what's relative to what's relative. It must be relative ultimately to what's not relative. Even Einstein's theory of relativity, now I don't know too much about it except a poem. There was a young lady named Blight who traveled much faster than light. She started one day in a relative way and returned the previous night. But I do know this, that Einstein did not believe everything was relative. He believed in two absolutes, one, the speed of light in the physical universe, and the other one, God, the absolute spirit by which everything else is measured. Six, moral disputes call for an objective standard outside the dispute. This is where C.S. Lewis begins in his book, A Mere Christianity, a couple of people arguing. Now, if there is no objective law, remember this. There has been no meaningful moral dispute in the whole history of the world. No one ever has had any meaningful moral dispute because it was all relative. It's inconceivable that the people who say Hitler is right and Hitler is wrong, that there's no meaningful standard by which we can measure it. The Taliban is right or the Taliban is wrong. You got to have a standard. Lewis put it this way, the moment you say that one set of moral ideas can be better than another, you are in fact measuring them both by a standard saying that one of them conforms to that standard more nearly than the other. But the standard that measures two things is something different from either. that argument, this argument, that value, this value. You have to have something by which you measure them. 7. We don't invent the moral law any more than we invent mathematical or physical laws. No one invented 3 plus 3 is 6. Newton didn't invent gravity. He discovered it. In fact, Adam and Eve did when they dropped the apple. Didn't go right, didn't go left, didn't go up, went down, right? No one invents mathematical laws. No one invents physical laws. And no one invents moral laws. In fact, I wish I could invent moral laws, because every time I'm inconsistent, every time I don't do to someone else what I want them to do to me, what hits me over the head? The golden rule, right? Boy, I'd like to get rid of that baby, because it makes a hypocrite out of me every single time, right? If I could manipulate the moral law, I would do it. So would every depraved human being. We discover them. They're there. They're part of the furniture of the universe, and they cannot be moved. Universal moral guilt shows there's a universal moral law. There wouldn't be any psychologists if there weren't guilt. Guilt is the number one problem in the psychology. Everybody has guilt. Even girls who believe abortion is right and have an abortion cannot escape guilt. On the baby's birthday, they feel depressed. They get guilty. They sometimes get suicidal. There are all kinds of problems. And if you could just wave a magic wand and say, that's all subjective, there's no objective basis to any guilt whatsoever, you could make a mint. But moral guilt shows that there's universal moral law. I was debating an abortionist in Houston on a TV program once, and the lady slipped. I mean, it was a really bad Freudian slip, because she felt that I wasn't being compassionate enough about girls who get pregnant outside of marriage. And she said, well, you should be more forgiving toward these girls. And I said to her, why should we be forgiving if it's not a sin? You only forgive a sin, right? That's a bad slip. Of course, we should be forgiving. But you can only forgive something that's wrong. You don't say, somebody does something real nice to you, you say, oh, I forgive you for that, for being nice. No, you forgive something that's wrong. And she didn't realize what she had said. Lewis again, making excuses for our faults. You wouldn't make an excuse for your fault, and we all do. We all cover up, make excuses. It seems then that we are forced to believe in a real right and wrong. First, human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way. Second, they do not, in fact, behave in that way. The truth is, we believe in decency so much that we cannot bear to face the facts that we are breaking it, and consequently, we try to shift the responsibility. Shows there's a moral law there. 9, we sometimes choose duty over instinct. People say, well, that's just herd instinct. It evolved that way. It's survival of the fittest, and, you know, that's what animals do. Yeah, but we sometimes do things against our instinct. What does your instinct say when you see that? Stay away. But what if your baby was in there? I mean, our neighbor's house burned. We, by the way, never buy a house next to us, especially behind us or in front of us, because we've had the house on the right side burn and we've had a house on the left side burn. So it's very dangerous to live in the neighborhood near us. But the house on the right side of us was burning over in Carson's Pond when we lived there. And the neighbor lady rushed home, and her cat was in there, and she was going to run in the burning building, and the fireman had to restrain her just to get the cat. Not a human being, even. We sometimes choose duty over instinct. Why, if there is no moral law, why would we do that? Why would soldiers go in harm's way for their country? 10. We all find some things evil. Genocide, racism, bigotry are candidates. If that doesn't turn your stomach, if that doesn't hit your moral sensitivity to see these mass graves from the Holocaust, then what would? We all find some things evil, and if there's anything wrong anywhere, and surely this is one, then there must be a moral law and a moral lawgiver. There are many things we don't want others to do to us, like lie, cheat, abuse, or kill. Well, do unto others what you would have others do to you. That's the golden rule. Even Confucius saw the negative side of that. Don't do unto others what you would not have others do to you. Now, how do we know that? We wouldn't know that if there weren't a moral law. You don't have to read the Bible to know that. You don't have to say, oh, I know where that is. That's in Matthew 7:12. Well, you probably didn't even know it was in Matthew 7:12, but anyway, that's where it is. There are many things we don't want others to do to us. Now, you don't determine what's right or wrong by what you want to do to others. That just proves your depravity. What do I want to do when somebody cuts me off in traffic? Cut them off, right? What do we want to do? We want to do to them as they did to us. We may lie, we may cheat, we may abuse, and God forbid, some may kill, but try lying to me or cheating me or abusing me, and you'll find out what I really believe, and you'll find out that we all believe those things are wrong. 12. The same basic moral codes are found in all major cultures. C.S. Lewis wrote the best book on this topic. It's called The Abolition of Man. He has an appendix in the book in which he shows that prohibitions against disrespect for parents, lying, stealing, and killing are found in all major cultures in the world. He gives quotes from them. It's probably the most important appendix in a single book that I've seen in a long time. It simply is not true that ethics are totally different in all cultures. There are differences, to be sure, but there's a common thread of a moral law that runs beneath those that says, do good and shun evil. Do unto others what you would have others do to you. Now let's combine these arguments. The cosmological argument shows there's an infinitely powerful God. The teleological argument shows he's infinitely intelligent. He designed this whole thing. The moral argument shows he's absolutely perfect. That means there can only be one God. Why? Because you can't have two infinites. It's like having two alls. You can't have two alls or two supremes. And you can't have two morally perfect beings. Why? To have two beings, one would have to differ from the other. If they didn't differ, they'd be identical. To differ, one would have to lack something the other one had. But if it lacks some moral perfection, it's not absolutely perfect. You can only have one absolutely morally perfect being. You can only have one infinite being. And the anthropic principle that says the whole universe is one was designed from the very beginning, and it's a universe, not a multiverse. It has one set of moral laws, one set of physical laws, one set of mathematical laws. It has one mind behind the whole thing. Hence, the combined arguments show that a theistic God exists. Let me add one more argument. And this one actually is more powerful than some people than the scientific arguments. This is called the argument from religious need. It goes like this. All persons need God. Theists admit it, and atheists reveal it. What we really need really exists. Therefore, God really exists. Now, let me tell you what this argument is not. I'm not saying everybody wants a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, therefore there is. It's not an argument from want. It's an argument from need. What you really need really exists. Secondly, this is not an argument that says everything that people need, they get. No, there are people that need water and die of thirst. There are people that need food and die of starvation. What the argument says is this. If you really need it, it is somewhere to be found, whether you find it or not. For example, here's one of the most brilliant scientist in the world, happens to be a born-again evangelical Christian, Dr. Francis Collins. He's in charge of the most prodigious scientific project ever undertaken by human beings, mapping the whole human genome. Here's what he said. Why would such a universal and uniquely human hunger for God exist if it were not connected to some opportunity for fulfillment? Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger? Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim? Well, there's such a thing as water. If you really need it, it really exists. We really need God, therefore God really exists. Now, one of my hobbies is reading atheists. I love to read atheists. I read atheists for devotions. I do. Because every time I read an atheist, it encourages me in my faith. When I see the slim grounds upon which they're atheists and that they really need God. And one of my hobbies is collecting quotes from atheists that prove that they too needed God. Now, we know theists need God. We admit it. Now, if I could show atheists really need God, then we have shown that all people need God. Here's what one of the most famous atheists in the modern world says, Jean-Paul Sartre. I needed God. I reached out for religion. I longed for it. It was the remedy. Had it been denied me, I would have invented it myself. Not bad for an atheist. I really needed God. Sigmund Freud on God. He admitted it would be very nice if there were a God in his book, Future of an Illusion. He admitted a sense of man's insignificance or impotence in the face of the universe. That's just another way of saying, I need God. I'm powerless, impotent in the face of the all. He even referred to our God, Logos. He had a substitute God, Logos, in The Future of Illusion, pages 52 and 88. Paul Witz. Now, here is a man who was a converted Freudian psychologist. He's a born-again Christian. He wrote a book, The Psychology of Atheism, The Faith of the Fatherless, in which he showed, by doing a Freud on atheism, in which he showed that the father, the need for a father, is not something we conjured up. It's something that's really there. And all of the great atheists he shows in this book had a defective father image. They either didn't have a father, or their father died when he was young, or had a dysfunctional father, and he goes through. And here's what he said about Freud's argument that Christianity is an illusion. Nowhere did Freud publish a psychoanalysis of the belief in God based on clinical evidence. Nowhere. Provided by a believing patient. Instead, there is now much research showing that a religious life is associated with greater physical health and psychological well-being. Just to the contrary, religion isn't a crutch. It isn't a cosmic Linus blanket, a heavenly comforter, something we need, something that we wish to be true. It's something we need. We actually need God. Nietzsche was the one who said, God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. But notice what he said in the next line. How shall we, the murderers of all murderers, comfort ourselves? Now that we've killed God, what do we do? Where do we get our comfort? Last week we were talking a little bit in the question and answer period about the problem of evil. And I pointed out that there were three things. I never got to the second and third one. There are three reasons why evil doesn't eliminate God. It really calls for God. It calls for God as a moral standard by which you can judge evil. But it also cries out to God for help while we're going through the suffering. Who can help us? I'm going to give you more quotes here showing that these great atheists cried out for God in suffering. They needed a God and didn't have it. And the greatest atheist to ever live, this guy right here, Friedrich Nietzsche, said this, I hold up before myself the images of Dante and Spinoza. They both believed in God, who were better at accepting the lot of solitude. What do you do when you get lonely? I hold up their images. Of course, their way of thinking compared to mine was one which made solitude bearable. They were believers and they could bear the solitude. And in the end, for all those who somehow still had a God for company, I hold this image up before myself. Then he said, my life as an atheist now consists in the wish that it might be otherwise and that somebody might make my truths appear incredible to me. If that isn't a crying out for God, then look at this. In Thus Spake Zarathustra, he wrote a poem to the unknown God. Remember Paul in Acts 17, preached a sermon on the unknown God? And here's Nietzsche praying to God. Thou lightning shrouded one, unknown one, speak. What wilt thou, unknown God, to the last of all that are lonely, oh, come back. His father was a pastor. His father died when he was young. Oh, come back, and my heart's final flame flares up for thee. Oh, come back, my unknown God, my pain, my last happiness. It's a man crying out. The greatest atheist who ever lived, crying out for God. David Hume, the greatest skeptic who ever lived, couldn't tolerate his skepticism. He got so skeptical of his own skepticism that he's writing the book that he had to put it aside and go out for a walk in the woods or get out a game of backgammon and play to get relief. Listen, most fortunately, it happens that since reason is incapable of dispelling these clouds of doubt, nature herself suffices to that purpose and cures me of the philosophical melancholy and delirium. Why? He had to turn to nature for comfort, and nature became the surrogate for God. It became really capital N, and go for a walk in the woods. Or, he said, go have a meal or play a game of backgammon or have a conversation with a friend. And when after 3 or 4 hours amusement, I would return to these speculations, these skepticism, they appear to me so cold and strained and ridiculous that I cannot find it in my heart to enter into them any further. Does that sound like that was a happy life? A life of skepticism without God? Here's another famous atheist, Albert Camus, in the book The Fall. For anyone who is alone, without God, and without a master, the weight of days is dreadful. Did you know something that all these atheists have in common? They all smoked, and they all looked unhappy. Bertrand Russell, another one. Even when one feels nearest to other people, something in one seems obstinately to belong to God. Now, for the modern world's greatest non-theist, agnostics, that's interesting. At least that's how I would express it if I thought there was a God. It's odd, isn't it? I care passionately for this world and many things and people in it, and yet, what is it all? There must be something more important, one feels, though I don't believe there is. They come so close. They need God. They cry out for God. Walter Kaufman, this is one of my favorite quotes. He was an atheist at Harvard, wrote a book, Critique of Religion and Philosophy, said, religion is rooted in man's aspiration to transcend himself. Whether he worships idols or strives to perfect himself, get this, man is a God-intoxicated ape. Not bad. Man is a God-intoxicated ape. Camus put it in these words, despite the fact that there is no God, at least the church must be built. Why? What do you go for? What do you go there for? There's no word from God. There's no hymns to God. There's no God to pray to. Tell me, why do you go? Erich Fromm, humanist psychologist, said, indeed, man does not live by bread alone. He has only the choice of better or worse forms of religion. There is a need in everyone's heart for God, atheist or theist. Will Durant said, I survive morally because I retained the moral code that was taught me along with the religion while I discarded the religion. You and I are living on a shadow because we got rid of the moral lawgiver and still want a moral law. But what will happen to our children? They are living on the shadow of a shadow. That's where our children, that's where our culture is. Do you know what's inscribed on the Jefferson Memorial in big marble letters? Just stand in front of Thomas Jefferson, look over the water toward the White House, and look up, and you'll see something like this. God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. Can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God? I was just with David Barton this past week and some other Christian leaders in Missouri. David Barton showed us a 7-minute video. They're reconstructing kind of a underground Capitol, a visitors thing where they have, instead of having to walk to all the things, you can actually see it all there. And it's got many of the great monuments. You can see inside the House of Representatives and all of this sort of thing. And they have taken all of the inscriptions that refer to God or prayer or the Bible off of it. For example, right over the head of the President of the House of Representatives in large letters, it says, In God We Trust. Your TV camera usually cuts it off, so you can't see that. They don't even have it in this reproduced Capitol that's underground there. And they've taken other ones out as well. And we need a protest. They're literally taking God out of the monuments by recreating new ones and doing it underground, and people are going to think that's the way it really was. What's wrong with humanism? Even the atheists realize there's something wrong. The British Humanist magazine charges that humanism is almost clinically detached from life. This is our humanist talking about humanism. It recommends that they develop a humanist Bible, a humanist hymnal, 10 commandments for humanists, and even confessional practices. In addition, the use of hypnotic techniques, music, and other psychological devices during humanist services would give the audience that deep spiritual experience, and they would emerge refreshed and inspired with their humanist faith. They want a humanist Bible, humanist 10 commandments, and humanist hymns. So I wrote a couple songs for them. Plato, lover of my soul. No one ever cared for me like Socrates. Or my hope is built on nothing less than Jean-Paul Sartre and nothingness. If they need a few more, I will stir up my creative mind to make some more hymns for them. Durant said, atheism is a shadow of a shadow. Nietzsche said, it's not bearable. Huxley said it's intolerable. Camus said it's dreadful. Sartre said it's cruel. And Hume said it leads to delirium. That's what atheists think of the atheist life apart from God. The main point? Atheists say with their lips that there is no God, but they show with their lives that there is a God. They can't avoid Him. We cannot get rid of God. Those who deny God with the top of their minds nevertheless cannot avoid Him in the bottom of their hearts. And you can say all you want about the revival of atheism, a big bunch of books that are coming out by atheists. They all need God in the bottom of their hearts. They're just denying Him in the top of their minds. Erich Fromm said, the need for an object of devotion is deeply rooted in the condition of human existence. It's part of our very essence made in the image of God. Camus said, nothing can discourage the appetite for divinity in the heart of man. Well, then why do people reject God? Final point. You can lead a horse to the water, but you can lead the horse to the water. I gave you a good cosmological, good teleological, good moral argument. I gave you argument from need. Gave four powerful arguments put together for why there is a God and why we need Him. But you can lead a horse to the water, but you can't make him drink. Just look at the reaction of some scientists to the evidence that the universe had a beginning and therefore maybe a beginner. Eddington said, philosophically, the notion of the beginning of the present order of nature is repugnant to me. Now, why should a scientist who is supposed to be cool, collected, and calm, and just looking for facts, why should he say that's repugnant? It's true. I should like to find a genuine loophole. Why? Because it points back to a creator. Einstein said, and he was a pantheist before the evidence for the beginning of the universe came along, God is all and all is God. This circumstance of an expanding universe irritates me. To admit such a possibility seems senseless. Why? Because I believe in Spinoza's pantheistic God who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists. Because if you're a pantheist, it would be repugnant to have a beginning because you'd have a God that had a beginning. You find out the universe isn't God. It's a creature. It's not the creator. Robert Jastrow hit the nail on the head. There is a kind of religion in science. It's the religion of a person who believes that there's order and harmony in the universe. There is no first cause. This religious faith of the scientists is violated by the discovery the world had a beginning under conditions in which the known laws of physics are not valid as a product of forces or circumstances we cannot discover. When that happens, guess what? The scientist has lost control. God is sovereign and I'm not. Whoa, can't let that happen, right? Other reactions. Julian Huxley said, for my own part, the sense of spiritual relief which comes from rejecting the idea of God as a supernatural being is enormous. He even admitted on national TV that he was an atheist evolutionist because he didn't want to change his sexual practices. Well, if there's a God and he has a moral law, then you're going to feel a little uncomfortable, right? In doing that kind of thing. Friedrich Nietzsche said, if one were to prove this God of the Christians to us, we should be even less able to believe in him. Now think about that for a moment. Any rational person, if you prove it to them, should be even more willing to accept it, right? Not an atheist. If you could prove God to me, I would still not believe in him. In fact, he said in another place, when you tell me I must obey God, hubris, pride, wells up inside of me. Because we don't want to obey God. St. Paul put it this way. He speaks of those who suppress the truth by their wickedness, because what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. Every design has a designer. Everything begins has a beginner. Every moral law has a moral lawgiver, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. To show you the bias, to show you where these people are coming from, every once in a while, one of them gets honest. Probably had one or two drinks before he wrote this. But listen to how honest Harvard's Richard Lewontin was. We take the side of science, he means naturalistic science, in spite of the patent absurdities of some of its construct. I know evolution is absurd, but we're on its side anyway. Because we have a prior commitment to materialism, that there's only matter, no God. It's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a materialistic explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori, before looking at the facts, prior to looking at the facts, adherence to material causes. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, here it is, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. That's why we cannot allow intelligent design into our schools. We cannot allow teaching that the Declaration of Independence is true in our schools because of our prior commitment to an atheistic worldview. Conclusion, if God exists, miracles are possible, truth is absolute, morality is absolute, Bible is credible, and life has an ultimate purpose. If God does not exist, then miracles are not possible, truth is not absolute, morals are not absolute, the Bible is not credible, and life has no ultimate meaning. But God does exist, as the evidence shows, from the beginning of the universe, intelligent design of life, the moral law, and the need for God. Therefore, miracles are possible. Truth is absolute. Morality is absolute. The Bible is credible. And life has ultimate meaning. Makes a big difference. All right, let's stop there and give you a chance to comment or make any questions you have regarding point three, does God exist?
I have some friends that have gotten involved in what they call the secret, where God is actually nothing more than energy in the world. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
Is that a new form of atheism?
Well, it's probably in that form, it's more like pantheism, but ultimately they're both non-theisms or atheisms, so atheism in the broad sense of the term. Why is it that God can't be a physical force? Because all physical forces had a beginning. All physical forces had a beginning. Why is it God can't be a spiritual force beyond the universe, but not an intelligent being? Because the universe is designed. It has specified complexity, irreducible complexity, anthropic principle that only a mind can do. Secondly, because non-mind can never cause mind. Karl Marx put it this way, either matter produce mind or mind produce matter. Matter can't produce mind because the lower never produces the higher. The effect cannot be greater than the cause. So all of their view is built on the absurd thesis that, get this, nothing produced something. Non-mind produced mind, non-conscious life produced conscious life. It doesn't happen. It's not rational. Come now, let us reason together, saith the Lord. Good point. Over here.
Dr. Geisler, with the current political climate that we have in the United States today and what's occurring in the elections itself in the past, historically, it's always been surrounded by, you know, what economic policy or, you know, the debate is on a different level. But lately it seems over the last, say, 40 years or so, it's now come down to a philosophy on one party that believes that abortion is wrong, one party that believes homosexuality is wrong, one party that seems to have a moral standard, while the other party, philosophically, and I'm not saying the people within that party are evil or anything, but it seems overall, you know, having been at a convention where I saw protests outside where witches, Satanists, and the like are protesting against Republicans, there's something going on here on a larger level. Would you care to comment?
Well, first of all, it's not a question of whether God is on our side or God is on the side of Republicans or Democrats. It's a question of whether Democrats and Republicans are on the side of God. Get Lutzer from Moody Memorial Church. Get his sermon on this. It's an excellent sermon. So I think we better be very careful in identifying with God's cause with any one side of an aisle or any one party. I would be glad to vote for Sam Nunn as President of the United States. I would be happy if the Democrats would put forth a pro-life candidate, somebody who's for life. So We ought to vote principle over party, and we ought to vote morals over money. And sometimes it's on one side, sometimes it's on the other side, and sometimes it's not clear which side is correct. And what do you do? Then, as a black friend of mine says, sometimes our choice is between a known devil and a suspected witch. So you vote for the suspected witch over the known devil. Sometimes it's a half a loaf over no loaf, and sometimes it's a slice over no loaf. But do, by all means, when you vote, vote morals over money and vote principle over party and vote life over death. And if you are having a hard time figure it out, just call me. I give you some brochures that have the records. No, seriously, they've looked into the records. And the way you tell what somebody believes is, how did he vote? So it looks over the voting records of the candidates on all of the issues that are of concern to Christians, and then you can make up your mind and decide. Good point. Anything else? Yes?
Dr. Geisler, were conditions like this before some of the revivals in our country years ago, where there was there a main thought of thinking of atheism before the first and second Great Awakening in our country?
Were there conditions like this before the Great Awakenings in our country? Not to the degree of atheism that we have today. There were deists and there were skeptics even during the revolutionary times. As I said, it even penetrated some of our early fathers, because a deist is kind of, an agnostic or an atheist who still believes in God but has given up God's involvement in the world. So we had deists even among the signers of the Declaration of Independence. But atheism was so repugnant and was so unheard of that the constitutions of many of the states, including North Carolina — just whip out the North Carolina Constitution and you will see that an atheist cannot hold office, that you had to be a believer in God to hold office. That's still in the Constitution. Of course, it's a violation of the First Amendment, and you can't practice it, but it's still there. It's still there. And that was true, that atheism just was almost totally unheard of. You can get a little feel for it in the wording of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. It was just absurd to think that there was no God. Not to the degree that we have it today. Anything else? All right, let's pray. Father, we thank you for the privilege that we have to speak the truth, to be here tonight. There's nobody that has a gun pointed at our heads. And there's nobody that can say that what we're doing is not in accordance with our Constitution. And we just thank you for our freedoms and for our liberties. And help us to remember that when we go to the polls and when we examine the candidates and when we look at America and our country, and help us to realize that what George Washington, his first inaugural address, said is true. There is an inseparable relationship between morality and happiness and morality and prosperity, and that the propitious smile of heaven, as he said, will no longer be upon us because we have forsaken that. And help us, we pray, to do what is right and to vote what is Christian and to put our conscience in practice as we exercise our freedom. And help us as we study together how to defend our faith, to be able to do it more articulately and meaningfully, and to see how the whole Christian faith is rational, is persuasive, and for anyone who is willing to believe, the evidence is more than ample. We pray these favors in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.